Blog Talk Radio.
Talk about organized crime and mob-related subjects with the people who have been there and done that. Our guests will include former mobsters and lawmen, crime reporters and true crime authors, and others with intimate knowledge of the world of organized crime. You can participate in tonight's show through our chat room or by calling in at 646-478-0982. Mob Talk is presented by Bear Media Consultants. Bear Media is the place to go if you're looking for a consultant for your organized crime film or documentary, a source for a book or article, or a speaker for your event. Please visit www.bearmediaconsultants.com for more information. My name is Denny Griffin, retired investigator and true crime author. Our producer, Kim Colton, is manning the switchboard and chat room for questions that will be asked near the end of the show. I'm happy to be joined by my co-host, former Gambino crime family associate and author, Andrew DiDonato. Andrew.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I'm glad to be here. Tonight we got a very good guest, a very dear friend of mine. His name is Frank Collada. Frank Collada, me and him have done many things together as far as, you know, promoting our books and going do these open forum discussions with people. And Frank is a very interesting character, very nice guy, gentleman. I love the way he carries himself. Frank, good evening, buddy.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Andrew. And I'm glad you clarified that we do business, legitimate business together. We are
exactly,
no longer
Frankie.
Involved in that crummy world that we were in.
Exactly.
I hear giggling over there. Is that my friend Griffey?
That's Griffey, the Griffey, Frank. And
what can I do for you?
Frankie, I wanted to just add on to Andrew's introduction here that you were the basis for the Frankie character played by actor Frank Vincent in the movie Casino in 1995. And in 2007, Frank became an author when he wrote his biography, Collada, The Life of a Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. So are we up to date, Frank?
Yeah, thanks for the plug, Benny. I didn't expect it.
you're very welcome.
But I'll take it.
Frank, you know, Andrew and I will both be asking you questions then near the end of the show. If Kim's gotten any questions through the switchboard or through the chat room, she'll let us know, and we'll address those as well. But I'd like to kick it off.
Benny, I got to interrupt you. I only got about 15 minutes.
Uh-oh.
Well,
we're
going
to go as fast as we can.
All right. No problem. I'm sorry about that. I'm in the vehicle.
Okay. Well, we'll get right at it. When, you know, Tony Spilotro was a boyhood friend of yours, and you did some things with him in Chicago, and also when he moved to Las Vegas, you joined him in Vegas afterward and became what they call in parlance his lieutenant. You ran a street crew for Tony that was dubbed the Hole in the Wall Gang. And the movie Casino, Joe Pesci plays a character based on Spilotro, quite a tough guy. And in real life, Frank, how did Pesci's portrayal of Tony relate? Was he anything like the real Tony Spilotro, or was it total Hollywood?
Well, it was a lot of Hollywood there. Tony never swore as much as Pesci did in the movie. Tony was basically a quiet guy, well-mannered, well-spoken. And if he was mad, you'd see it in his eyes. He didn't have to scream at you. So the portrayal was pretty close, but, you know, like I said, he didn't use that kind of vulgarity in real life.
And was he as tough as Pesci made out to be? Was he that kind of guy?
In his younger years, as we were growing up, he was very tough. But in the years that we were lost that good punch that he used to have. So he got a little softer. But, yeah, to answer that question, he was tough when he was younger.
Okay, and just since you were going to be a little short on time, Frank, Kim, if you would, if we got questions for Frank that come in, you know, that you get, we got probably about 15 minutes or so. Why don't you let us know in about 10 or 12 minutes, and we'll cover what questions we can before Frank has to go, okay?
We'll do.
Okay, thanks. And Frankie, another thing I wanted to discuss was regarding Casino. One of the more graphic scenes in the movie was this one where Pesci's got a guy's head in a vise, and he's asking the guy some questions, and every time the guy doesn't answer right, he cranks the handle on that vise. And eventually, the guy's eyeball pops out, and then he tells Pesci what he wants to hear, and then he's killed. And now, that was based on a real-life incident, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But the scene was changed around for Hollywood style. Actually, his head was pushed down first with his eyes facing the floor, and that's when a vise was tightened up on his head.
Okay, and did you know what happened, what was behind this thing, or what caused this guy to be in that kind of position?
Yeah. Him and this other guy, Jimmy Moralia, the guy's name that he gave up after his eye was popped off, I was supposed to go on his hit with them, kill these two brothers, the Scavo brothers. And the one particular night that they'd done it, I had been occupied with some young lady. We were on a date. And they went and got the guns from me, and they went and did the hit, and they killed the two brothers and a cocktail waitress that worked for the brothers in a suburb in Chicago, Elmwood Park, where it's controlled by the syndicate, the outfit, I should say. And they committed two no-nos because the two brothers, their father, the Scavo brothers that were killed, their father had ties with Tony Arcardo, not criminal ties, but, you know, you grow up in an old neighborhood and all these Italians know each other. So, you know, the father reached out, and Arcardo was mad for several reasons, and that's when the bosses took over.
So it was all over fight. So Tony scooped this guy. Now, that the guy with the head in the vise, that was Billy McCarthy, or the real-life character was Billy McCarthy?
Yeah, that was Billy McCarthy.
And they came to be known, I believe, as the M&M murders, McCarthy and Moraglia?
Yes, that's what happened. They give them that. They got that label, the M&M murders, you know, Moraglia and McCarthy. M&M.
And did that help, do you think, Tony, to make his bones, as they call it, or become a made man when he did that?
It really helped a lot, although he already had made his bones, but this really jacked him up a little bit, and of course it pushed me along the line too, because I was instrumental in setting up these guys, which I had no alternative, but I had to do it. It was either me or them, and, you know, self-survival. So
yeah, you were going to go if you didn't.
Oh, they'd have killed me. Yeah, they'd have killed me. Because I used to steal with these guys. They were my partners.
And, Frank, who was, now this had nothing to do with Casino, but in real life, of the bosses you're familiar with in Chicago, or maybe anybody you've heard about from New York, for example, and Andrew might want to comment on this, who is the most effective or the best boss, an organized crime boss that you're aware of?
Well, my belief was Tony Arcardo, because he had it distributed, the bosses, in a way that he was completely shielded by any kind of repercussions he could get. And it was tightly controlled, where they didn't go around killing. One boss wouldn't kill another boss. They'd have to go and get these okays with four or five guys sitting in a meeting. So it was a well-run outfit in Chicago. So I believe Tony Arcardo was the mastermind of that. Very, very smart man. Never went to jail. Never went to jail. Whereas anybody that sits in the captain's seat usually goes to jail.
Hey, Frank.
So he died of natural causes, right?
Yeah, he died of old man, natural causes.
Andrew, now what do you think? Of course, you didn't work for the outfit. You were with New York City.
Yeah, but you know what? I got a better question for Frank. This is one that has nothing to do with the movie. The movie was a fascinating portrayal about just some of the things that Frank was involved in. And, you know, Frank, as you know, within the book or in the movie, there's so much more of your life that never really gets portrayed. And the question I got to Frank is, Frank was, you know, he was a prolific thief, you know, throughout his life. And I know that that's one of the reasons why the guys in Chicago sent Frank to the Vegas area. And my question to Frank was going to be, Frank, when you went out to Vegas, you know, to be with Spilatro and take care of business in Vegas to make money, doing scores and stuff like that, did they give you the leverage to go and take guys from Chicago with you, guys that you robbed with before, guys you were comfortable with, or did you have to cultivate a crew out in Vegas yourself and school them one by one?
Well, what happened was I was told that I had to go out to Vegas. Tony requested it, and the boss has sent me out to Vegas more or less to watch his back because he felt like he might have some threats against him. You know, who knows what they were at the time. So when I got out there, Tony told me to bring a crew with me from Chicago, whom I was tight with, who he didn't want to meet. I see he's sheltering himself from anybody else, and the only one he's got to talk to is me, and they would talk to me. So in turn, I brought out several guys from Chicago, and two of them were already living in Vegas. So I did ask Tony once they got out there. I said, now listen, these guys got to earn, you know, and I know we don't give paychecks every week. So and it's a no-no to steal out there from what I understand. And he said, well, you know, you got the okay and that from back home. We know they got to earn. He says, and if you got big, big scores, he said, then, of course, you know, I want 10 or 20% depending on the amount of the score. He says, they're little scores, scores meaning robberies. He said, I don't want nothing of it, and I only want to deal with you. And I said, what else do you want me to do for you? He said, well, I want you to muscle bookmakers and guys from other outfits, like guys from New York and Detroit and Boston, which there was renegade bookmakers out there. Their bosses would send them out there, and they bookmake. So Tony wanted to get that action, not letting them other cities know that he was behind this master plan to muscle their bookmakers. And then the bookmakers would cry to their boss. Their boss would call Tony. And then Tony would tell us to back off the guys, and they would pay him tribute.
Yeah, so, that's the old squeeze play, Frankie.
Yeah, it worked. They worked real good for him.
So Tony sends you guys out to muscle these guys. You muscle them, and their boss is back in their home city, calls Tony and asks you if you'll provide protection.
Yeah, they would call him and call Tony and say, listen, you got guys out there. Send your guys out to get these guys off my guys' back, and we'll make sure you get a piece of the action. And it worked out. It worked out. I know three or four guys that it worked out.
And you should shake down some drug dealers too, right?
They were the easiest. Who are they going to run to? You know, they can't complain they got robbed. So any chance we got, we'd rob drug dealers. He didn't like that, because he didn't want us to become drug dealers. And we told him, we're not going to become drug dealers. We're just going to turn it over, you know, real quick. We're not going to sit there and sell a joint at a time or an ounce at a time or a liter, whatever it is. We just sell the whole pound or a kilo real fast for less money. And, of course, he would get a shot at that money. So, yeah, we took drug dealers down all the time. We liked getting them.
And like you say, who are they going to beef to?
They got nowhere to go. They're going to say, I got
to go.
40 pounds of dope.
Yeah.
Sitting ducks then. You know, that we should do the same thing, Frank. They were sitting ducks and nobody to complain to. And you play the good guy, bad guy with them. You know how that game works.
Yeah, where are they going to go? They ain't going to go nowhere. They're the best. They're the easiest marks. Of course, they could be dangerous, you know. I mean, you could get in easily, you know, shoot out with them and have to kill some of them, you know, because... you know, that's a dirty business they're in to start with. And as far as we were concerned, it was a dirty business.
Was adapting to the Las Vegas scene, Frank, when you first started committing crimes out in Vegas, was adapting to it as opposed to Chicago?
What was it? I'm sorry, you didn't hear the first part. You broke up the first part.
Was it hard adapting to, you know, starting to do scores out in Vegas, you know, from Chicago? Like Chicago, you know, you had your ear to the streets, you know, your whole life there. You know, you knew who owned what, who did what. Was it a lot different for you?
No, as a matter of fact, it was different surroundings, but it was easier. It was easier because it was like virgin territory to rob. And, of course, we had insurance companies, agents that would give us tips on people that had a lot of jewelry in their houses, and they would actually know what kind of alarm systems they would have in the house. And this was fed back to us, and then we give them a percentage. And most people that you rob, they all got insurance. These people had insurance, so they didn't care. They're going to get that stuff back. They're going to get more back because they're going to complain about more was stolen than actually was. You know, I've seen a lot of that happen.
So, for Frank, what you're saying is if I'm a legit citizen in Las Vegas with some money, and I go out and I buy my wife a new ring for her birthday or something, and I go to my insurance agent and say, hey, I want to get this new ring covered on my rider. And the agent says, okay,
right.
How much is it worth? Where do you keep it? Is it secure? How often does your wife wear it and all that stuff?
Yeah.
So I tell them, oh, yeah, I got a safe under my bed, and that's where it is. And then when I walk out of the office, they give you a ring and say, hey, Frank, I got some news
down,
for you.
Stop down. I'll meet you on the street. We'll have a cup of coffee. That's what they say. You meet him, you have a cup of coffee, and he tell you. But, you know, not all agents were like that. There was a couple we had in the town, although we had a lot of them in Chicago. But in Vegas, it was a small place. I think there was about 850,000 people at the time. I always considered it a fishbowl, you know. If they ever got out, they could just pluck you right out of there.
Now, when you did your residential burglaries, and I guess that would be any place, whether it's Chicago or Vegas. But you probably over the years learned where people tend to hide their stuff.
Yeah.
Did you have where you could go in and say, okay, I think one time you told me, Frank, that like behind the light switches or stuff, or, you know, those.
Yeah, that's the jewelry. They take out the light switch and they sit it in that socket inside there. Another spot people would think was safe, and we found these things out, you know. You learn as you go along. And clothing bags, laundry, you know, clothing bags that hang in the closet, you know, they're square bags, and they got a cardboard bottom. A lot of people put their money underneath a piece of cardboard in these bags that hung up or in the bottom of a hamper, you know, and they have a bag in there over that, and they put the money there. I mean, there's so many obvious places to us, but they thought they were great spots. You know, I mean, the only one that had money underneath a bed would be a fool. You know, even a dumb thief lifts up the mattress.
Even a dumb thief lifts up the mattress. But you know what? Let Frank hit it right on the head because, you know, over the years, you know, when you have a large sum of money and you're looking to put it in places like that, and you're in a house and you're in an apartment, you know, your options are kind of limited unless you own your own home with a backyard or stuff like that, and you could dig up a hole or something like that.
But then you're gonna watch you don't have a dog because the dog will dig it up.
Yeah, see,
that's
so
happened to me already.
You know,
my own house.
That's an occupational hazard.
Well, one time I had a bunch of jewelry, and I said, yeah, I don't want to leave it in the house, and I get my family in trouble. So I dug a hole in the backyard and covered it up real nice. Next day I come. Well, that night my wife says, there's jewelry and everything floating in the pool. I said, what? And I looked at that son of a bitch. Took all that jewelry out of the hole and just scattered it all over the yard. The dog. So I learned a lesson from the backyard. I should have put it in a can. You would have pulled that out, too.
See, Dennis, we do what we know. Me and Frank did a few of these events, and like when me and Frank get together and we talk for a while, there's so many things. Even throughout, I've been in the street my whole life, but yet hanging around with Frank and getting to know Frank, there's so much that I still learn over the years. So it's like no matter what you've been through in your life, you could always learn, especially from a guy who's older than you, a little bit older.
Hey,
like
what's your father older than you?
Hey, generations I'm talking about. And Frank is a different generation. And it's funny because our lives mirror each other. You know, we went through a lot of
that's
the same
true.
Trials and
thank
tribulations,
you.
And, you know, we have that rapport with each other, and we can relate to a lot of things. So I learn of every time I'm with Frank, I learn something new. So it's always a pleasure
thank
for
you.
Me.
Just don't use it. Or else I'll be visiting you with commissary money.
My love.
Now, Frank, you know, another thing that would be of interest to me, I mean, we talked about the crime and doing crimes in Vegas, but, like, when you weren't stealing, what was it like, the nightlife in Vegas, if you will, the social life? Was that something?
It was wonderful. You know, I mean, you're up all night. You slept all day, and you partied all night, you know, unless you were married and real, you know, a good husband. Although I never, could you hear me? Because I hear static. You know, I never. Hello.
Yeah,
go ahead,
I got you, Frank.
Yeah, I keep on hearing static. Although I never cheated on my wife, you know, I did party with girls that night, but I wasn't cheating. I wasn't doing anything, you know, to insult her. But of course, I was out every night, and of course, you know, we partied and we drank, and you know, we had fun.
And Frank, you were out there at the right time, Frank. Your time, your era there out in Vegas at that particular time was the right time. You know, the mob still had big influences in the casinos, and it was the right time to actually, you know, enjoy yourself.
I wasn't loaded with corporate people. You know, all these corporations there and they're not at that town. It's not like it used to be. And the people that live in that town now wish the syndicate controlled it again. What screwed that town up is when the people were convinced that they needed to change presidents in the culinary union, and we had the culinary union, and one day we lost that our president, and then that town went screwed up, and that's their own fault. These people, you know, they were convinced by the law enforcement that we were robbing from them, which we weren't. As a matter of fact, we did more for the culinary union then than the culinary is doing for their people now. Hello.
And that was the turning point, huh, when the president got ousted there, the culinary president?
Yeah, I think so. I really do think so. We tried like hell to keep it in there, but, you know, these people were brainwashed. Now they all realize it, but it's too late now. It's too late now. You know, it's done, it's over with, and that's their problem now, you know.
So. Yeah, well, absolutely. Frank, now you were a technical consultant to casino, plus you played in several of the scenes as a hitman.
Right.
I'm just wondering now, at that point, you were, what was that, 1995, I guess?
Yeah, it's been a long time.
How were you treated? In other words, when you came on the set, when people got to know who you were and your background, were they afraid of you? Did they like you? Did they treat you good? Or how was it mixing in with these actors?
A little bit of everything you said. The actors I got along with, you know, I got along with all the actors. I got along with Martin Scorsese. As a matter of fact, I was the only one that was a technical advisor that was able to sit next to him while we were doing the movie, because he always looked to me for directions on certain scenes, you know. So I sat there by him, and a lot of movie stars couldn't understand who I was at first and how I was able to sit next to Marty. They thought, well, this guy must be something in order to sit next to Scorsese. And then eventually they found out who I was, and they treated me great, really good, really good.
Well, good. Do you think you intimidated anybody? I mean, just when they found out, you know, who you were and your background, do you think you had anybody scared?
Of course that happens. You know, I mean, you don't try to scare anybody. You know, they just hear your background, you know, so you kill a few people, and oh, my God, they think you got 90 heads on your shoulder, you know. I mean, this is something
Frank,
I didn't want to do for a hobby, you know, but what are you going to do, son?
Hey, no. Frank, I can hear it now. Listen, Mrs. Scorsese, don't get nervous. Don't get nervous.
Don't get nervous, Andrew. Don't get nervous. All right, listen, gentlemen, I got to wind it up, okay?
Have you got just this one? Can you give us about 2 more minutes, Frank, in case we can sneak in a question quick from the audience?
See you later. I'm going to lose another girlfriend, kind of. Go ahead.
Okay, Kim.
Okay, Frank, we do have a couple of questions for you. One from our friend Ross in Scotland. He asks, did Frank contribute any facts, stories or knowledge to producers during the filming of Casino?
99% of it. I give them knowledge and stories. 99% of it. They could not have done that movie unless they sat down with me and go through the script. And this is a fact.
Wow.
So that's strong,
wow.
Frank. That's strong.
Oh,
that shows
strong.
You.
No, I
yeah,
wouldn't say
strong.
If it wasn't strong, you know.
No, that is. That's good.
I
mean it in a
positive
way.
I talk to Scorsese on a weekly basis, Nick Pileggi on a daily basis. Nick was the writer. And I talked to the movie stars, all of them way before the movie. We had special meetings together. And then they talked to me. And then once De Niro seen that I was legit, I was the real thing, he said, yeah, let's go with this movie. And then that's when I stepped into the position as technical advisor, and I did scenes in the movie.
Okay, Kim, you got a second question real quick?
Yes, yes, we do, from Ross in Scotland again. This is for Frank and Andrew. Please give their opinion on the Chicago outfit and the New York crime families. Which ones are similar? Are they similar? Who's the strongest? And if any of them have worked together?
You want me to answer some of that, Andrew?
Go right ahead, Frankie. That's for you, pal. Go ahead.
Sometimes, well, of course, we helped each other out in certain situations, you know, but not on a monthly or maybe a yearly basis, you know, when we couldn't use somebody in Chicago. As far as strength-wise goes, you know, I don't know. New York had five families, and there were five strong families. We had one in Chicago, and that was strong to us. As far as what was the other question besides that?
Which families are they similar? And
I guess they're all
did
similar.
Did any of them work together?
I guess, yeah, well, I said that. They're similar
yeah.
in a lot of respects because they're all crooked. Criminals, you know, they kill, they make money another way. Chicago didn't deal in narcotics when I was there. In other words, we didn't sell narcotics, where New York was involved in it. Chicago always felt that it was a dirty business where, you know, you kill each other over drugs. So that's the difference there. So, okay, Andrew, you got it. Listen,
Frank.
Did I cut out people? Yeah.
Go right ahead,
Frank. There's a guy named an FBI agent named Bill Romer. And this is from Gary.
He's a $3 bill.
So he wasn't instrumental in bringing Tony down.
He's a phony. He's a phony. Forget about it. Not even the FBI likes
Forget about it.
Hey,
Frank, listen. Will you promise you? We only got a little bit in the way of the stuff we want to talk about. Will you come back on another show sometime?
Say please.
Please.
I draw a line, Frank. I draw a line there. Either you come or you don't. I'll buy you dinner next time I see you. How's that? I draw a line and say,
buy me dinner or lunch or something. I'm busted.
You got it, my man. We know Grizzly ain't going to do it.
Hey, Frank.
God forbid. Are you kidding me? What?
Frankie, thanks a lot.
Right,
bye-bye.
Good night, Frank.
Oh, God, we could have spent another hour or so with him without
that's
any questions.
You know, it's always like that when me and Frank get together and stuff like that. But you know what? He's got so much history, you know. And it's funny, Dennis, because some of these questions that you're asking Frank tonight and some of the things, you know, I watch Frank, you know, handle these questions every time I'm with him from people. And basically, you know, it's so fascinating how so many years later, you know, his era in time and those guys had such an impact on the society in Chicago and out in the Vegas area. And, you know, that, you know, catapulted into a book, of course, and of course with a movie. And it just goes to show that, you know, me and you were talking previously last week about, you know, that Mom Museum opening up in Las Vegas. And you look at all of the entities of it. Now you see why, because, you know, the things that Frank and his crew did was so part of the history. You know, you don't sit here and say that, you know, thumbs up the criminal activity, of course, but as you can see, there's a big history there. And it's good
that
people learn that, without a doubt. And Frank is very much a part of that history. So, you know, it's always good. Even for me, it's a learning lesson. I mean, you know, me and Frank talk about guys and certain people that we both knew and stuff like that. And but like I said, every day it's a learning experience, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. Now listen, I got some good news here, Frank. Of course, something came up where he had to cut out on us early, but I think we're going to get a call in from one of a mutual friend of ours, Mr. Vito Colucci, I think, is trying to reach us.
Oh, Vito Colucci's online. There you go. There's an interesting guy. Now, Vito,
is that Mr. Vito?
Yeah, I tell you, I've been listening the first half hour, and I'm thinking to myself, that's a trifecta that lost money at the track. Listen,
Vito,
unbelievable. Would I have paid $8? What did I pay, about $8 for that trifecta? One guy wants to leave,
my man.
One guy wants to get out of the show because his girlfriend's bugging him. How are you guys doing? Congratulations
good,
on a great
Vito,
show.
Good,
good, good. Thank you. How's everything with you?
Yeah, good, good, good. You know, I got that Dennis Griffith pounding away on my book now there, Andrew.
We're through
17. We're on the 18th chapter right now. So we're getting there little by little. But, you know,
I
wanted to throw a couple questions at you, Andrew, if I can.
Go right ahead, sir.
Do you see the New York papers on a daily basis or no? Do you
follow, like, I try. Yes, I try.
Did you see
not every day, but I try.
It still amazes me because the organized crime thing is a situation that even if 30, 40 years go by, it almost stays the same. And what I mean by that, you see the guy that was arrested, it was in yesterday's New York Post for having all the information
the meat market?
On his Rolodex.
The Banana Crew, yeah.
Yeah. Denny,
that.
This is a guy that, you know, in these days and times when a lot of times the organized crime guys say, okay, look, you got this computer program. They would bring a computer expert in to teach all of the organized crime guys how to do this, how to get rid of everything completely. God forbid if somebody's coming to your house. Here's a guy yesterday, Denny, that wrote all his information, all his names, all the contacts, everything on his Rolodex.
Okay.
Yeah, it amazes me, how this stuff goes on. And one other thing I wanted to throw out to you two guys, I'm just looking at some, the New York Daily News did a thing, went back in time, and they kind of showed all the different police officers in New York, Andrew, that got involved in all of these organized crime things, you know? Some of the most recent, I'm sure you know who they are, that's Louis Eppolito and that Stephen Caracappa.
Sure.
Two cops, they were charged with killing eight mob hits. You know, they had retired. They moved out to Vegas, Denny. They were living the high life in Vegas, figuring they'd never get caught. And in 2006, they got popped, and I think they're serving life now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they both got life sentences. The case was it was a very complex case. You know, it's a shame because it shows, you know, I was talking about this the other day with somebody. You know, there are a lot of good law enforcement people around the country who do their job diligently. And, you know, they keep their nose to the grindstone and do what they got to do. Unfortunately, sometimes, you know, corruption runs a little deeper. With these guys, it was running deeper. And they weren't only corrupt, they were actually committing the offenses. And it made the guy who was paying them do it even more dangerous. You know what that is to have police on your payroll who are actually going out and doing that kind of work? It makes you even more dangerous.
Yeah, what they were able to do is, you know, being in the cars, putting the red lights on and stopping a vehicle and, you know, just telling the guy to pull over onto a side street and then they wind up killing him. I mean, they could stop whoever they wanted.
They did exactly there was a guy they killed right off the Bell Parkway. His name was Eddie Leno. And they pulled him over and that's where he was murdered, and I believe that was one of the cases that those guys were under investigation of or was found guilty of.
And you know, I have the book from the mafia cop book from Eppolito, and I mean he was before he got involved in all this, he was a very prestigious cop. He won every big award that was out there. He was promoted to detective, the top of the line detective, this and that. I mean, and it's a shame, you know, what happened to him. But you know what I want the listeners to understand is that what these cops don't realize, across the country that get involved in organized crime. I worked undercover on it. But these guys here that get involved with the mob, there's no love between the crooked cops and the organized crime guys. And I don't know, and either side knows that, okay? The mob don't like the crooked cops, and the crooked cops don't like the mob. They want the money. But do these cops think in their wildest imagination that when the shoe falls on one of the mafia guys, you don't think they're going to hold up in their hand, well, give me a break and I'll give you these two cops? Do they not think it's going to cave in on them 10 years, 20 years from now? It's amazing how they don't think that, because that's almost their get-out-of-jail card by saying, I can give you something that's tremendously big. I'll give you two guys that killed eight mob hits. Go easy on me. You know what I'm saying?
I can't comment on their mindset at all. I can't comment on their mindset, but, you know, what it does is it shows you the level of greed that's involved when people get involved in activity like that, where the money blinds their thinking. They're not looking 3 or 4 steps ahead or years down the line. They're worried about the money they're making at that particular moment. They're caught up in the moment, and that's how these things fall wayside. There's nothing funny about the scenario, but you know what it reminds me of, Dennis? You know, we were talking to Frank Collada before about some of the things that were in the movie Casino, and I remember there was a guy who owned a deli somewhere. I think it was in Kansas City or in the Midwest somewhere. This guy wrote down everybody's names in a book as well, Dennis, and got everybody in trouble. And same thing that Vito just brought to our attention about that guy from Williamsburg, Brooklyn. This guy got caught with a Rolodex with everybody's information and on the phone talking about collecting Shylock debts and this, that, the other thing. And this is something, Vito, and even you, working undercover all these years, and it's the first rule of thumb that you learn in the street growing up. Do not talk on the telephone. Do not talk on a telephone. And yet these guys, now with all the technology that law enforcement has, these guys are still talking on a telephone. It's amazing.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's amazing. And then he knows from writing my book, I went out on the street and I had every bad guy whispering things in my ear about my own bosses who was protecting them. So, I mean, you know, just to give you one example, it's not limited to dirty cops. I did a Bill O'Reilly show about Elliot Spitzer, the governor of New York, when he went down about 2 years ago. And I said on the show, I said, does Spitzer actually think, again, like these two cops, he went through every different madam. He went through all these prostitutes. Everybody knows who he is. Does he think that not one woman, one girl, is going to tell her girlfriend, who's going to tell her husband? I mean, it boggles my mind that they think that they can get away. Ellie Spitzer would go with his guards, check in on the 6th floor of a luxury hotel. He would say to them, all right, I'm going up to the 7th floor for a couple hours. And they would want to go with him because that's his protection. They say, no, I'll be up there. I'll probably be spending most of the night up there. I mean, all it takes is the one time where somebody dangles that thing and says, I got something really big for you here. I got the governor of New York. I got two crooked cops. You follow me, Andrew, what I'm saying on this?
No, 100%. And the only thing that I could attest to that, you know, like I said, I can't comment on their mindset, but the only thing that I could attest to that is that you get such a, you know, an aura of power of yourself where you feel empowered.
Right.
And now you feel as though that you're above everything that's going on around you, and you're really not thinking clearly because all you're doing is just getting caught up in the moment, whatever money that put in front of you, or, you know, being able to control, you know, the situation, maybe like Spitzer was, or stuff like that. That's the only thing I could see it being.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I don't want to take up your whole show on that, but in looking at that yesterday, I had to laugh. He had everything taken care of properly, this guy, and yet he still had his old-fashioned Rolodex on his desk that had information on every single thing they were doing. You know,
well, I'm sure
phone
the
numbers
guys in that Rolodex are not happy with him this morning.
Throwaway phone.
I'm sure.
All the numbers, all the throwaway phone numbers that he bought at Kmart, all the throwaway phones, were all listed on there. I mean, you know, it's incredible. the more things change, the more they stay the same. You mentioned before, you and Denny, about people still talking on the phone, first rule of thumb. Well, you go back to the Goodfellas movie. What does he say to the babysitter and everybody? Don't talk on the phone. And that movie's, 30, 40 years ago as far as when it takes place, actually.
And now think of the technology that law enforcement has today at their fingertips. I mean, put it this way. Whenever there's money involved, there's always going to be some sort of criminal element. Nobody's going to get rid of criminal elements, whether it be organized crime or any other criminal element, as long as there's money and there'll be corruption and stuff like that. But for you to be in the street and think that you're still going to follow those protocols, that the way that I grew up with that structure of organized crime, you can't win. There's no winning. There's no way. Just, get ready. You're going to jail. It's just a matter of when. It's not if you get arrested. It's just when you're going to get arrested.
Yeah, and not only that, talk about new technology, Andrew. I'm sure some of the listeners know, but most listeners do not know. All of the new cars, or 90% of the new cars over the last several years, have a black box in them. Okay? Now, they have an actual black box. Now, that is used for, when it's used the proper legitimate way, that can show in a fatal accident everything that went on or this or that. It's a great tool for accident reconstruction and things like that. But on the other hand, too, it can also track, if the investigators want, it can also track all the organized crime guys. It's six of one, half a dozen of the other. So a lot of them are, equipped with these black boxes now in the new cars. And
even the black boxes. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There was guys now where, law enforcement gets a hold of your cell phone or something like that. And even if your cell phone is off, it's a tracking device for them.
I've talked about this on several missing persons cases. You don't even have to have your cell phone on in the car. It pings off the towers. It pings off of the cell phone towers, and they can automatically see where you are at every moment. They can trace, somebody gets hit, if there's a mob hit in a certain part of town at a certain time of night, they can go back and see where exactly you were that night by your cell phone. And it doesn't have to be on, and you don't have to be talking on it. You see? All this technology.
Vito, years and years ago, when they first came up with those easy passes in New York, when they said, all right, listen, these easy passes are going to come, technology is great, you don't have to stop at the tolls no more, there's not going to be no more traffic. The first thing I said was, that was the writing on the wall. Everybody's seeing it. The easy pass was a way that they could keep their eye on you, know your comings and goings. So if they knew if you were not supposed to be in a certain setting, they know you crossed the bridge, you were in Manhattan or you were in Staten Island, wherever you went, they knew.
That's
if
right.
You used the easy pass. I mean, and it's convenient for the average person, but if you're, if you're out there doing shady deals or you're in the criminal element, I wouldn't advise using your easy pass. Because it's only going to come back to haunt you,
Something you think
you got away with a year ago is going to come back and bite you.
Well, guys, I'll let you go because I'm sure you got a lot of people.
Peter.
Hey, Denny, I see that a lady by the name of Grace Full James is on the blogging over here. I think I know her, Grace Full James. You know her, Denny?
I think the name has a faint ring to it, yes.
Yeah, a pretty girl. I saw her once or twice. The only trouble is I wouldn't buy a used car from her or her husband. They got a lot of mob connections.
Vito, don't hang up yet. I want to bring up another question you can get involved in.
Okay.
I wanted to talk just a minute with you and Andrew about one of the questions we had for Frank from Gary from Scotland was about this former FBI agent, who is now deceased, by the way, but he'd written several organized crime books. The fellow's name was Bill Romer, and the question from Scotland was, was he as instrumental as he claims in his books in bringing down Tony Spilotro and his crew? The answer from Frank was no, that he wasn't really in that. And when I was researching for my book, The Battle for Las Vegas, I talked to many of the cops and agents who had actually done the investigations.
Right.
And Mr. Romer's name did not come up you know, as being instrumental or a key player in that. And as authors, now Andrew's got a book, Vito, you've got one book out, and we're working on a second one, and I've written a few. It's very difficult, I think, and that question made me think of this. When you're writing true crime, or any nonfiction, it doesn't have to be crime, I guess, but anything that is supposed to be a true story or based
right.
on fact, and if you embellish too much, or even worse, make up things. I'm not saying Romer did this. I never read his book, so I'm not commenting
right.
about him. I'm talking generally. When you do that, if you get caught as an author, if they catch you, if the reader catches you in what is supposed to be a true story,
right,
with facts that just don't that aren't facts, where you're presenting facts that aren't actually true, you know, you can do tremendous damage to yourself. I mean, not only your reputation, but obviously the sales of your books and so forth. So that's
sure.
That's something I think, and you guys as authors, I think will agree with me. I hope you do. That the accuracy of your book is actually critical. I mean, it's nice to if you want to write something just to flower it up and so on and so forth, then you should write fiction.
Right.
But if you're going to write nonfiction, true stories, or allegedly true stories, you got to be pretty damn accurate.
Well, see, that's a good point, Denny, because there is a lot of guys that travel the country speaking. I know for a fact, one guy, I don't want to mention his name, who said he was a high-ranking member of the Castellano group. And a lot of people, when he was touring the Northeast, a lot of guys had said to me, did I know his name? And that was the same time I was working undercover. And I said, well, I don't know his name, but that doesn't mean anything. I don't know him all. But I did a lot of research, and I called a lot of people, and nobody had ever heard of this guy, that he was anybody. But, you know, that's a good point you bring out. And you know, Denny, in our book that we're doing together, it's, you know, right on the beginning of the book, it's going to say based on a true story, okay? But in saying that, all of the key components of my book, having the combat cross, the shootout, that's all legitimate, wearing a wire undercover, having the death threats, there's all front page headlines on that, all screaming headlines about that. So all of that stuff is true. Now, I don't have a problem with if there's a scene where I'm tackling a drug dealer and we're rolling around on the ground, and let's say in real life we rolled around on the ground and I finally handcuffed him or something like that. Now, you know yourself, Denny, from 11 books, well, to make that sound interesting, you may do, I tackled the drug dealer and we're rolling around the ground and my gun came out of my holster. We're both grabbing for it and I banged my head. I had a cut and I wound up arresting him. See, those are the things that to me aren't bad. You see, you're making that
right.
You're making that chase a little bit more. But all the key components of my book, you know, Denny, are strictly factual. All the main things, the Anthony Dolan stories, everything else are main. Based on a true story could mean just, you know, you're making a little bit more interesting in certain areas of it, you know?
Absolutely. And, Andrew, what's your opinion? Do you agree with that?
Well,
or
my opinion is this. Listen, I've been through so much in my life that, you know, I laugh. I say to people sometimes when they ask me questions, I say, you know, you can't make this kind of shit up, excuse my language, but you just can't. I mean, you know, I've been through so much throughout the years. And, you know, every once in a while when you put things to paper, like when me and you did it, Dennis, and we were going over the facts, and we were going over year by year certain things, I never realized how many things that I was involved in over the years because, you know, this is what you did for a living, you know, and this is what you were doing out there every day, and then you don't realize the damage you were doing. I mean, Dennis will tell you, Vito, we couldn't get it all in one book. You know,
yeah,
there was no way to get it all in there. So what you do is, like I agree with Vito, what you want to do is you have a – you know, you're there, you're entertaining the people, you're hopefully with your story that it's going to be found on an interesting basis that people can relate to it. Like with my story, I was looking to touch maybe a younger kid who maybe might be from my neighborhood within the United States or anywhere else who grew up in a crime-infested area where they believe that's normal activity, and giving them an opportunity to see no matter what mistakes you make in your life, you know, you can rise above it. And in
yep.
doing so, I share some of the trials and tribulations that I went through. But like Vito says, you know, you're entertaining at the same time, though you don't want to take away from the severity and the seriousness of these actual facts. You want to make sure that you got them on board so everybody
right.
knows, okay, this is not a disputed matter, and this is not a disputed matter, and this has happened on this date. And you know what? I've yet to see a guy who's going to lie about going to jail. I mean, Jesus, there ain't nothing I want to brag about.
Oh, I know. That's amazing.
Two times in my life, and a lot of people, you know, you're not going to make everybody happy with the book. There's always going to be critics and always going to be this and that. Just as long as you know in your heart, Vito, when you put it to paper, you gave it your best. You did what you had to do from your mind or what you could remember about these instances 15, 20 years ago, whenever they occurred. And I think with you, Vito, like I read your other book, I think I can't wait to read your second book. I think it's going to be a home run. I really do.
Well, you know, Andrew, like what we're talking about here, and the whole based on a true story. You got a box full of true stories. I got a box full of true stories. But when you get an author like Denny, and let's just throw out anything. You and your guy are about ready to jump on this armored car in front of a bank, right? You jump out. You're starting to make connections with these guys. Now, a true crime writer may say, okay, I got a police car that's pulling up a couple feet down the road. He's pulled somebody over and given them a summons. And now you're saying, oh, my God, how are we going to get out of here now? There's a cop car over there. To make it more interesting, you still hit the car. I mean, you still hit the truck. You still got the money. You're still in the process of going away. So now maybe they make it a little exciting. They say there's a squad car pulled over somebody giving them a summons. Hope
hey,
we get
Vito,
out of
you
here
brought
without...
up one of my cases. You just brought up one of my cases. I was
sitting
on the corner.
Hey, you read the book.
No, sir. There was actually a police car?
No. I'm standing on the corner. One of my things here. I'm standing on the corner. We're going to do a robbery of a place. I'm standing on the corner. It's nighttime. It's freezing. There's a car on the corner. This kid's going to come out of this place with a bag of money. The car's going to cut him off. I'm supposed to, you know, railroad him into the car, take the bag, and run. But a cop pulls somebody over on the street corner. We
no,
got to avoid permission because he's right there.
I swear to you, I never read that. I only read a half of your book, and I never read that. That's amazing.
Well, I don't even think that made the book, but it did happen. It was something that that did happen back years ago when I was out there committing offenses and stuff like that. And I never forget it. I was out there. I was freezing waiting for this guy to come out of this place. And then it just so happens, the way luck had it, the police officer pulled on the corner, pulled somebody over right in front of our stolen vehicle where we were going to railroad this guy with a bag of money. And we had to give it up. And
hey, gentlemen, I don't mean to interrupt, but Kim tells me we got some questions from the chat room. Kim, what do you got for us?
Hi, Denny. Yeah, we have about a few questions here. Let's start with Steve, and this one we're just going to throw out to anyone here. And this goes back to the earlier conversation, but he asks, how much have you heard about the mob infiltrating the SEC and Wall Street instead of running guns and liquor? I heard they started this back in the 80s and 90s.
It was very, very big, Kim, back in the mid-90s. There was a lot of what we call boiler rooms back then. Guys would open up. They would rent a space in Manhattan or even in Staten Island to get 15, 20 phone lines put in. They would get all of these kids who, you know, they would work on the one or two guys' licenses, and they get all these kids, and they would do cold calls all day. And what they would do is they would pick a stock, and they would take that stock, and they would pump it up. They would pump up the stock. They would get everybody to promote a stock, and the stock was really no good. And then what they do is they would pull the bottom out, and they would all get paid. And the people who invested the money would get nothing. They would all get had. They were pump and dump schemes. And that was very big in the 90s. Right? And, you know, getting the IPOs, getting all the inside trader information before these public offerings, you know, things became public and stuff like that. I mean, they infiltrated, and it is true. It did happen. I knew quite a few guys who went to jail for, you know, crimes against the SEC and not doing straight-on deals in the stock market.
Okay, and from Ross, and this is for you, Andrew, are you going to be on any mob documentaries in the future?
Well, I just finished filming a documentary. It'll be on the Discovery Channel sometime before the holidays, and I'm looking forward to it because I like the background of it. I don't want to give too much of it away. It, each day they're going to feature one different guy, and they did one with me. There's a few other guys in organized crime circles who used to be in the life who they also use their stories. So I'm looking forward to it. And, yeah, it's going to be in before the holidays. It's going to be on the Discovery Channel, from what I understand, yeah.
Discovery Channel, excellent.
From what I understand, and, you know, the production company tells me, but who knows? I don't know.
Okay. And, again, from our buddy Ross in Scotland, two more questions. Andrew, what do you think of Jojo Carozzo Sr., and I may not be pronouncing that correctly, is he going to trial, and is he looking at life?
From what I understand, the last that I heard of the whole scenario was that he was arrested. That, from what I understand, he was held without bail. I could be wrong on that matter, but I believe he was. And I believe he was going to be going on trial. And I think there was some litigation in courts that his son was going to try to represent him. His son is an attorney. And I think that there was some sort of back and forth between the government and the judge over if he could represent his father or not. I think he was taken off that case, but I do believe he is. And, yes, I believe with his criminal past, trial would mean a hefty jail sentence if he is convicted.
Mm-hmm. And the last question here we have from Ross is, again, it goes back to an earlier topic. Why did it take about 10 years to get those two mob cops? Didn't Queso testimony name them?
Well, what happened was, I don't know. I'm not a police officer or an FBI agent by any means, so I don't know why it took so long to make a case or not make a case. I don't know. I know that Anthony Queso, Gaspipe, that's his nickname, Gaspipe became a witness back in the early 90s. I believe that Gaspipe did give information regarding those two gentlemen. But there was some speculation about Gase's information, and I don't know if that's why it took so long. They were waiting for another source or maybe collaboration. I don't know, like I said, but they were ultimately arrested. The wheels of justice turned very slowly, that I could tell you.
Hey, Andrew, can I jump in on that last one?
Go right ahead, sir.
I know a little bit about that. Hi, Double K, Kimmy Colton, how are you?
Hi, Vito. Thank you. Fine.
See, what happens on a lot of cases, Denny knows, he already put it in the book there. The first day that I walked into my narcotics squad, eight of us, eight new narcotics cops in the squad, the chief of police looked at all of us and said to us, now, you know, you guys are going to hear a lot of rumors on the street about your bosses here. You're always going to hear he planted stuff on somebody, he's a crooked cop, that. It goes along with the territory. So what happens in life in those type of jobs, whether you're a legitimate narcotics cop or organized crime cop or you're a bad one, it takes a long time because you got to get through what would be considered the rumor mill to find out if something is actually the truth, because you're always going to hear, the bad guys are always going to say stuff about you. The only trouble is that sometimes the bad guys are telling the truth about you by saying, you took me in an alley and you beat me up and you shot Joe in the kneecap and the whole bit. So you have to, it takes a long time to get to the point where you through informants and documentation to get to the true facts that somebody is corrupt, like Eppolito was and Carrick Papa, whatever his name was there. So I hope I can answer that a little better there.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Listen, we're running out of time very quickly here. Vito, thanks a lot for coming on board with us tonight here after when Frank had to leave early. Really appreciate you calling in.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure listening to you guys.
Vito, send
take
my best
care.
To your family. Send everybody my love. Send everybody hello. It was great
thank
to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
Again.
We'll be out there soon, Andrew. Very soon.
All right.
Good.
I'll see you soon, buddy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks. I want to thank Frank Clotta for his time with us tonight, and we will get him back on when we can finish up. We had a whole list of questions we wanted to go through here, so we will have him back on. And our next Mob Talk show will be on November 16th, and we've been talking about the movie Casino a little bit tonight, and our guest is going to be former FBI agent Lynn Farron. and Lynn was the Vegas office case agent for the straw man investigations, and those were the casino skim investigations. And it's just absolutely fascinating stuff about really came what really came down and happened about that whole skim thing. And you'll find out, I'm sure, a lot of stuff that you didn't know or didn't get from the movie. So that's going to be the real deal. And we hope you can turn in again. That's going to be November 16th at 9 Eastern, and Lynn Farron will be the guest. I want to thank all of you for listening tonight. Don't forget to check out Bear Media Consultants, www.bearmediaconsultants.com. Let them help you get connected. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night,
Thank you,
Cam.
Everybody.
Good night, Andrew.
Have a good night. Good night.